You notice the sermon outline in the back of your bulletin. You'll see that we are looking this morning at 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and I'll read to you verses 16 to 18, our text this morning, under the heading The Right Point of View. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16 to 18. Paul the Apostle says, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." It's coming up to Remembrance Day, so maybe some of you, in order to get into the spirit of the important event of remembering what has gone on before us, would be inclined to rent a war movie. Let me recommend The Great Escape, great war movie from 1963. And there's a scene in The Great Escape right at the end of the movie, which sets our theme this morning real well, I think, especially if you remember the movie. But bear with me if you didn't. At the very end of the movie, this true story about 76 airmen, prisoners of war, mostly British, who escaped through the greatest escape ever planned in World War II, are rounded up and brought back, and they're debriefing with one another in the prison camp after they have had their days of running around the countryside of Germany, distracting Germans from the war effort, which was the point of the whole thing. And it turns out, and this is a historical fact, that 50 of these prisoners of war were rounded up and taken out into a field and gunned down by the Gestapo, which is a direct violation of the Geneva Convention and, you know, against all the rules of fair play in war. And it was murder. It was cold-blooded murder. So this is what they were talking about in the prison of war camp after it was over. And the one particular fellow, played by James Garner, picture that, says to the commanding officer in retrospect, "Do you think it was worth it?" That is, was all the activity of getting the 76 men out for a few days, three of them made it to freedom, but most of them came back, and 50 of them were murdered in cold blood. Do you think it was worth it? And the immortal words at the end of the movie from this senior commanding officer are, "Well, that all depends on your point of view." And it does. And so do many other things. The right point of view is absolutely essential to thinking the right way about difficult things, like the slaughter of 50 good men. Next Sunday, November 14th, is the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. The International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And we will be focusing our attention next week, Lord willing, on the horrible reality of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of brothers and sisters of ours in the faith, people who love the Lord Jesus like we do, in prison or under torture or about to be executed for their faith. It's a horrible thing. So horrible that all our inclinations are to think about it very briefly, if at all, and stop thinking about it. It's one of those things, part of our world, that's just too horrible to keep thinking about. And the difficulty is that if we shut it out because it's too difficult to deal with, we won't do anything, when in fact there are some things that the Scriptures command us to do. So I'd like to prepare you for the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church next Sunday, by this Sunday, looking with you at the right point of view. That is the way to look at Christian persecution, and for that matter, other horrible things as well. So we're in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And just to understand the perspective of the writer, we need to read the verses previous to this. This is Paul the Apostle speaking. This is not Mike Wilkins the pastor. I feel I have no right to speak about the right point of view in regard to persecution, having never really been persecuted for my faith in any way. But Paul the Apostle has the right to speak, and his words are recorded to us as God's word. So let's look together, starting in verse 8. Paul says, he means himself and other apostles like him, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not despairing. We are persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh." And this, in a sense, is a listing of his credentials. Here's a man who has the right to speak about the right way to look at this horrible thing going on in the world today in places like the Sudan and China, where Christians are routinely being persecuted and even tortured for the faith. Paul the Apostle, too, was persecuted. Paul the Apostle, too, was tortured for his faith. So he has the right to speak to us, and we should listen to his words. It will help us to focus our attention rightly on some terrible things going on in the world that we must take some sort of responsibility towards. So here is what he says in our verses this morning, which will help us to maintain the right point of view about these horrible realities, and I would say other horrible realities as well. For other horrible realities suffer the same fate in our minds. If we try to get our minds around the facts of global poverty and the hundreds of thousands of children who are starving to death right now, or if we think about war, as we may on this week of Remembrance Day, or we think about the carnage of abortion as it continues in our country unchecked, we think about horrible things like the child sex industry here in the city of London, too horrible for us to keep our attention on for long, so that we don't keep our attention on these things for long, so we don't do anything. And that makes us irresponsible. So this is a very important part of the equipment of a Christian, the right point of view that allows you to focus your attention, as you must sometimes, upon terrible things, so that you can do something about these terrible things. Here's what Paul the Apostle says. We start with verse 16, where again he says, "We do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day." And so the first step towards the right point of view, number one, is to compare the physical to the spiritual, to compare the physical to the spiritual. Now, it's a fact of life. This is how God made us. We human beings are unique in all the world. We are both physical and spiritual beings. There are creatures like us in the world, in the sense that there are animals who are entirely physical. They have gallbladders and livers and intestines like we do. They have what we have physically. But they don't have a spiritual side. There are creatures in the world made by God that are like us spiritually. There are angels and there are fallen angels. There are demons. But they're altogether spiritual. They don't have a physical side. We are right in the middle of the creation. We are physical and spiritual at the same time. This is what's unique about us as God's creatures. And we need to keep both in mind at all times in order to understand what we are seeing. Both the physical and the spiritual are significant. You can't ignore one or the other without misunderstanding what you're seeing. So if you take, an atheistic view, a totally materialist view of the world, and see human beings as nothing but material objects, nothing but physical objects, you'll misunderstand what you're seeing by the human race. And if you somehow neglect the physical side of life, you'll equally misunderstand what you're seeing when you look at the human race. Both are of significance. And what Paul the Apostle is pointing out in verse 16, as you compare the physical to the spiritual, is sometimes there's a huge gap between what's happening on the physical and what's happening on the spiritual. What's true of the physical, what's true of the spiritual. This is possible. It's possible that they're tightly together, that when someone answers your question, "Hi, how you doing?" by saying, "Fine," he speaks the truth. Maybe he is fine both physically and spiritually. It's possible. But sometimes there's a huge discrepancy between the physical and the spiritual. And we're all familiar with this possibility. Think, for example, perhaps of a godly, old man. Maybe your great-grandfather, who's a great man of God. And perhaps physically he is a wreck. He can't hear well, he can't see well, he can't chew well, he can't think well. Maybe on the physical side, he's just falling apart. But he served the Lord in his day. For decades, he served the Lord and he stored up the scriptures in his heart. He is what you want to be if you get to live that long. So spiritually, he's doing wonderfully well. And he's ready to step right off this world into the next world. He's ready to go. So spiritually, he's in top-notch shape, though physically, he's a wreck. This is sort of the picture that Paul the Apostle gives when he says, our outer man is decaying, though Paul's outer man, Paul's physical, wasn't decaying from old age as much as from being beat up constantly for his faith. The inner man, he said, is being renewed day by day. It's possible to have this great gap between the physical and the spiritual. It can work in all sorts of ways. Think about, don't think very long, but think about some typical supermodel. Think quickly. Though there she is, absolutely beautiful physically. Her whole life is dominated by the fact that she is so absolutely perfect physically that she can make a fortune just looking that good. But what's going on the inside would be a question. And maybe she's a really awful person. Maybe she's vain and arrogant. Maybe she's cruel. Maybe she's just mean-spirited. She might be a spiritual wreck while she's a physical embodiment of perfection. Now stop thinking about her and think about your own experiences, say in high school. Wasn't it true that some of the most attractive people were some of the ugliest people and some of the least attractive people were actually the most beautiful people? And wasn't that what you learn in high school, as everybody sort of grew up to be more or less adults and some were good people and bad people, but beautiful people and ugly people? Paul says you got to keep both in mind all the time to have the right point of view. Compare the physical to the spiritual. And he goes on with that, and we'll jump to verse 18. And he says in verse 18, "We look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." So step two from verse 18 would be that we must look at the unseen rather than the seen. Look at the unseen rather than the seen. Now this, of course, is a figure of speech, because you can't literally look at the unseen, right? I mean, it's a contradiction in terms. You can't look at what you can't look at. You can't see what you can't see. But we use the word see or look figuratively to mean consider, focus your attention as if you could focus your eyes upon it. And this is, as unnatural an act as it is, a very important and necessary act for us to get the perspective right, to see that what you're looking at isn't everything about the situation that's true. There's other things that you can't see. So you mustn't size up any situation just on the basis of the things that you can see. And Paul said, because the things that you can see are all temporal. Nothing you can look at, literally look at, is going to last. But there's things that are eternal that you can't see. And you need to focus your attention, like you need to focus your eyes upon them. And the Bible is full of stories that give us this sense of how important it is to focus on what you can't see. So think of the familiar story of Noah's Ark. And there's this old man, and he looks like the only crazy guy in the whole world, because everyone's living their busy lives, doing all the things that they're doing in the days before the flood, except there's one guy who's spending an inordinate amount of time building this great big waterproof box. He looked, if you just use your eyes, like the one guy totally clued out. But of course, he was the one guy who was preparing for the future. He was the one guy who was living properly in the days before this global catastrophe. You couldn't tell by looking, but you couldn't tell by looking at the scene what was actually going on. You had to look at the unseen. In this case, the unseen blanket of water that was about to descend upon the human population and destroy everyone who wasn't in that waterproof box. Think about David and Goliath. It looked like a hopelessly unfair fight. Here's this young guy, this young, handsome man, maybe 18 or 19 years old, and then this great big giant of a guy in full armor. Looks like an unfair fight. And, you know, the insider's joke is that it was an unfair fight, but exactly opposite to what you would think. Because the young guy without the armor had the Almighty God on his side, and the poor sap in the armor didn't have a chance. But you couldn't tell by looking. So you see this thing, and if you just focus on what's seen, what's temporal, you get a totally distorted view of what's actually happening. And this isn't just true of Bible stories. This is true of all of life. Think about a contemporary subject. Think about church life in London. And there's all kinds of churches, and you're fairly familiar with this one, most of you, and a little bit familiar with some others. And so you could compare and contrast, as people invariably do. And from that, you could, if you had to, you know, make up a short list of the best churches in London. Perhaps you get to do this sometimes. People move to town. They say, should we go to church with you, or should we go to some other church? And then you give them a short list of the churches to try. And you're thinking, because you don't, you know, you're not sadistic and trying to mislead your friends. You're thinking of the good churches. So you go over your mind, what's good about the churches in London? And if you look at just what's seen, you might get a totally wrong idea. And you might totally misinform or misdirect yourself or your friends. I mean, if you just go by external appearances, there are some churches that are beautiful and some churches are kind of dingy. There are some churches that are full and some churches are kind of empty. But if you look at what's unseen, you might see that the churches that are full are actually empty. And the churches that are a little bit empty are full. And the churches that are poor are actually rich. And the churches that are rich are actually poor. And, I mean, you have to look at all things, including the things you can't see, if you're going to get the story quite exactly right. And with those two foundations set, that we must compare the physical to the spiritual and look at the unseen as rather than the seen, we're ready to look at the heart of what Paul is saying in this text, and that's the middle verse, verse 17. So here's what Paul, who's eminently qualified to speak on the subject of suffering Christians and who has taught us how to get a right point of view, has to say about, this is what he has to say about suffering. Verse 17, he says, "Momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison." So what he says, this is our third point this morning, is that we are to contrast present suffering to future glory. Now, once again, you just have to realize Paul is in position to speak. And I say again, I'm in no position to speak. I mean, I'm not at all qualified to stand up here and say, on the basis of all the suffering I've been through for the cross, let me tell you, the suffering doesn't compare to the glory. I feel very uneasy about saying that. especially considering the fact that pastors in other parts of the world today are in prison, and their families are being tormented, and they're being tortured, and here I stand, never having suffered an ouchie for the gospel, I mean, never having hurt for the gospel at all. But it's Paul the Apostle speaking, and he had really been through it all by the time he writes this letter. Just a quick second reference, in chapter 11, it's verses 24, 25, and 26, where he lists in more detail his suffering. Talks about five times being lashed with the 39 lashes, and three times being beaten with rods, and once actually being stoned, which was a form of execution, but he escaped it. And three times he was shipwrecked. He spent a night and a day in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. And he lists in verse 26 a number of dangers that he lived under. So he really was an expert about this whole subject of suffering. And he was able to say, and we must believe him in regard to his own testimony and in regard to others who have suffered after him, as those brothers and sisters of ours are suffering these days. The present suffering does not compare to the future glory, but you only see that by trying, you know, by finding the contrast. And here's the nature of the contrast as he lays it out. In this passage, and it's in various scriptures as well. He says, by contrast, the suffering of this present world is brief compared to the future glory, compared to what God has in store as a reward for those who are faithful. By contrast, it's brief. This is what James 4:14 says about life in general. He says to the people he's writing to, you're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. I mean, every single one of us is just a whiff of smoke. We're here for a while, and then we're gone. And so if our whole life is just a whiff of steam, just a little bit of a vapor, then so is the period of horrendous suffering that God calls some people to go through. Now again, I'm not qualified to say that about these people who maybe languish in prison for 10 or 15 years. But the biblical perspective, this unseen rather than the seen perspective, is that the suffering of this world is a very brief thing. And Paul says it here. It's momentary. Even if you live for years in suffering, it's momentary. And that's the first thing you need to bear in mind. The second thing he says, and here you need someone qualified to speak to dare say it, but he says it. He says, by contrast, it's light, momentary, light affliction. Now, he's talked about all the beatings he's received. He's talked about being executed, although he didn't get killed in action. I mean, he talks about all the horrendous things he's gone through. And he says, it's light. It was just a light affliction. It was just a little bit of, it was just an ouch. It was just a little thing. And that's what he says in Romans 8:18. He says, I compare that the sufferings of this present world are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. And this, I remind you, is a contrast. It's not that the suffering isn't horrible. If it wasn't horrible, we wouldn't need to think about it. We need to think about it because it is horrible. But by contrast with the glory that's coming, it's just a light, flimsy little thing. And it's here in this verse 17 that he uses that wonderful phrase, an eternal weight of glory. The glory that comes is this big burden, this big, wonderful burden of reward that God has in store for us. And it is so big. It is so substantial. The word glory in the Hebrew actually is based on the word for weight. It means substance. It means heaviness. The glory that's coming to the people that God will share his glory with is such a heavy thing that the heavy burdens of this world seem light by comparison. Now, Paul was not out of his mind. He knew that the suffering of this present world was a burden. In fact, he calls it a burden back in chapter 1, verse 8 of this letter. He said in setting up this letter, chapter 1, verse 8, we don't want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. There he said it. So we were burdened excessively. And that word burden is the same word that shows up here in chapter 4, verse 17, as the burden or the weight of glory. So it's not that the sufferings are light in themselves, but by contrast with what's ahead of us, it's light. You got it from the Apostle Paul. Momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. Which brings us to our conclusion about this under this third point. Contrast present suffering to future glory. By contrast, it's brief. By contrast, it's light. And by contrast, it's worth it. By contrast, it's worth it. God is not mocked. What a man sows, he will reap. And God has never defaulted on any payments. If a person reaps to the Spirit, he'll reap eternal. If he sows to the Spirit, he'll reap eternal rewards spiritually. And God is faithful to see to it that every obligation, every entitled reward is paid. The writer to the Hebrews, whoever he was, spoke to persecuted people of the same generation and says in chapter 10, verse 32, "Remember the former days when after being enlightened you endured a great conflict of sufferings." These people were in it too. "You endured a great conflict of suffering, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. You showed sympathy to the prisoners. You accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, don't throw away your confidence," the writer says. "It has a great reward." He speaks there about people joyfully accepting the seizure of their property. These are the people, the poor wretches, who lost everything for the gospel. But they were to joyfully accept the seizure of their property because in losing their stuff in this world, they gained much greater stuff in the next world. So that it shouldn't have been a horror to them. It should have been actually kind of a treat to them to lose everything in this world. Only by contrast with what comes ahead. By contrast, the suffering of this present world is worth it. Now, this is not the natural way of looking at things. This is the supernatural way of looking at things. This requires faith, which, as we saw last week, is a matter of humbling yourself enough to trust God and trusting God enough to obey Him. So humility, the humility to take God at His word, is required here. And trust is obviously necessary as we dare to take on behalf of suffering Christians around the world, this heavenly mindset and obedience as well. And obedience is called for because there are certain things that we must do for people who are suffering. We're not, on the basis of what we see here, to back off and say, well, then there's no real problem, is there? There's a tremendous problem. Our brothers and sisters are bleeding. Our brothers and sisters are dying for their faith. They're being cruelly tormented. Their children are being taken out in the streets in the villages of Sudan and being gunned down, those who are not carried away to be slaves. Horrible things are going on. But we dare to focus on those things long enough to really absorb what's happening because we have, or can have, the right point of view. So the conclusion for this morning is simply this: by not losing heart, as Paul the Apostle says, he says, therefore we do not lose heart as we take the right point of view. By not losing heart, we can stand looking long enough actually to do something. If we are able to focus our attention upon the horrible things of this world and not lose heart, then we can look long enough to actually do something. And as we will see, there are some things that we should do. But meanwhile, we have this work to do in our own minds to prepare ourselves to face squarely the suffering in this present world. We'll hear some horrible stories next week, not to rub anybody's nose in it, but we'll hear some horrible stories about some horrible things that are going on in this day and age. And it's important for us, you know, in preparing to focus on that, to get our bearings and to realize, well, yeah, physically, in terms of outer man, in terms of the things that are seen, these people are suffering terribly. And if there's something we can do, you know, if there's government offices that we can petition, if there's a relief that we can send in any way, then by all means we should. But let's remember that on a spiritual level, in terms of the weight of glory that's being stored up for them, they are the blessed ones. Now, we must help them. We mustn't slough off their suffering. But we must realize that they may, in fact, be the ones who are really doing well in the world today. While we who live in these luxurious places, like London, Ontario, and don't suffer for our faith at all, may be the ones who are spiritual wretches, maybe the ones who aren't doing very well at all. Perhaps they should be praying for us. And I think, in fact, some people in those parts of the world do pray for the poor, besotted Christians in North America. Now, it's not profitable for us to feel guilty about living here. And there's no point in us trying to develop some sense of shame at never having suffered for our faith if God has not called us to suffer for our faith. If your calling is to live out your life in London, Ontario, then you ought not to feel bad about obeying your calling. But if we're escaping from suffering, if we're having a particularly easy time of it just because we refuse to stand up for Christ in these easy places, then there is cause for shame and guilt. And all that gets straightened out as well when we compare the physical to the spiritual, when we look at the unseen rather than the seen, and when we contrast the present suffering to the future glory. We must focus our attention upon what's going on in the world from the right point of view, and this right point of view will equip us to look at what's going on in our own lives and our present level of how well we're doing physically and spiritually. We'll be able to see it better as well as we take upon ourselves this right biblical perspective. So I would encourage you to brace yourself for next Sunday by considering this passage this week. Perhaps read it each day this week or a couple of times this week. And just feast your mind, feed your mind on these words from this eminently qualified expert on the subject of suffering, Paul the Apostle. He says, "We don't lose heart, for momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison."